The United States looks forward to finalizing a great bilateral trade agreement with the United Kingdom. This is an incredible opportunity for our two countries, and we will seize it fully.
That was Donald Trump speaking during his visit to the UK in July 2018. But what do these words really mean? Welcome to Vox Talks, a series of interviews with some of the world's leading economists. My name is Tim Phillips, and today I'm talking to Dennis Novy of the University of Warwick about the prospects for a UK-US trade deal after Brexit. Dennis recently submitted evidence on this topic to the House of Commons Select Committee on International Trade, so he's definitely the right person to ask. Dennis, welcome.
Hi, Tim. Great to be with you.
Now, this is a special time for trade economists, Dennis. We've never talked so much about bilateral agreements or non-tariff barriers. So today I'm going to quote some of what politicians and official documents have said about this subject, and I'm going to ask you to translate for us. Is that okay?
All right, that's fine.
But first of all, before we do that, after Brexit, how important will a trade agreement with the US be to the UK economically?
Well, it's potentially very important. After the European Union, the United States is the biggest economic market for exports and imports for the United Kingdom. So therefore, if Britain decides to move away from the European Union, we don't quite know that yet to what extent that might happen, then it seems quite obvious to move in the other direction towards the United States. So yes, there is potentially a big prize to be had.
During Donald Trump's recent visit to the UK, there was a lot of sweet talk about the trade deal and a lot of enthusiasm. But when you look at what's actually happening, the US has recently imposed tariffs on the European Union. Is there a difference between what they would like us to hear and what the reality is?
Yes, there is. There's certainly a lot of sweet talk where people say, oh, we'd love to have a trade deal with Britain. It's a special relationship and so on. Now, that's all wonderful. But if you look at the actions, the picture looks very different. There's a big contrast because the United States has imposed tariffs on a lot of countries, including the European Union and thereby on Britain. And that means actually it's been harder ever since Donald Trump became US president for British firms to export to the United States. On top of that, the US has threatened even more tariffs on cars, for example, that would also impact the UK economy and the UK exporting sector. So I would urge some caution here. We have to not just listen to the nice and sweet words, we actually have to look at the action and what's actually happening on the ground.
Let's start by casting our minds back to 2016, when Barack Obama memorably said that if a new negotiation over trade deal was needed, the UK would be at the back of the queue. Also, Boris Johnson, former Foreign Secretary in the UK, said Britain would be first in line. They can't both be right. So who do we believe?
I'd say the truth is probably somewhere in between, but it's all very, very hypothetical. So look, the way you have to think about a trade agreement is that it's politically very costly. You can negotiate all that you like, but at the end of the day, you have to get it through Parliament or through Congress, and there's a big political cost to it. And in fact, whether it's a small country or a big country that you're dealing with, you have to get it through Congress, and that's a fixed cost. Now, if you think about that political cost, who would you rather want to have a trade deal with, a big guy or a small guy? So obviously, most countries try to do the big deals. And in that sense, I think Barack Obama was saying, well, you know, Britain is not really at the top of our list. At the time, the US was negotiating with the European Union, TTIP. And of course, that would have been much more important to the United States than any deal with the UK. Now, things have changed. On the other side of the Atlantic, there doesn't seem to be any appetite whatsoever to do any trade agreement with anyone these days. So therefore, I'm not sure there is a queue at the moment.
More recently, Woody Johnson, who is the US ambassador to the UK, said the US would get negotiations done fast because it's a major priority for Donald Trump. We've also heard from Dr. Liam Fox, who's the UK's International Trade Secretary. He said that there's going to be dozens of new trade deals ready to sign the second after Brexit. I'm assuming that Dr. Fox was exaggerating for effect here, but what does getting it done fast mean for a trade agreement of this scale?
If you are really fast, you would get it done from the start of negotiations until ratification in, say, 3 years. But that's almost unheard of. A much more realistic time frame would be something like 5 to 7 years, or perhaps even longer than that. It's very unlikely that anything along those lines would happen within the current parliament in the UK, and perhaps even not even within the presidency of Donald Trump, even if he gets reelected. That said, I should also point out is we keep on talking about this as if there's a free trade agreement or some agreement that you can have. Now, you can have a very light agreement, which has almost nothing in it, that can be negotiated quite quickly. And then you can go out to the press and say, hey, I got this fantastic trade agreement. Wow, how amazing this is. But it won't do anything economically. It's just something on paper. Or you can have a much deeper agreement, which is much harder to negotiate. You have much more nitty-gritty detail to go through, and that will take much longer. So that is the trade-off, depth versus time.
Whatever happens, definitely not the second after Brexit, though.
Unlikely. I mean, as I said earlier, I don't think there's any appetite in the United States at the moment for any trade agreement. In fact, they're quite busy withdrawing from negotiations. They withdrew from the Trans-Pacific Partnership, TPP. That was one of the first things Donald Trump did when he was sworn in as president. And they're also quite busy while renegotiating NAFTA, while renegotiating is perhaps a slightly optimistic way of putting it. They're probably trying to reduce NAFTA in scope in some ways. They have killed the trade agreement with the European Union. They haven't started negotiations on anything else. So therefore, I'm not sure whether anything's going to be ready at any time. And on the UK side, the Department for International Trade, headed by Liam Fox, is still fairly new. They're still trying to get together a trade team. Still, at the moment, they're of course, a member of the European Union. They cannot negotiate anything with anyone else. So therefore, I think it's very unlikely that anything will be ready at the point of departure on Brexit Day. But also, one very clear indication is we just have to listen to other countries. So the UK has said, oh yeah, Australia would be really interested in doing a trade deal. India would be really interested in doing a trade deal with the UK. Well, if you speak to people from those countries, they say, well, yeah, it would be really nice to do that. Let's talk about immigration first. Let's make it easier for people from India to enter the UK. Let's make it easier for Australians to enter the UK. Of course, that is a bit of a red rag. Reducing immigration is a really important agenda right now for the government. So it won't be an easy walk in the park, and I do not think that anything will be ready on the day after Brexit.
Dennis, I'm sure in your job you've read all 500 pages of the US Trade Representative's report on foreign trade barriers for 2018. I was looking in it. There's not much about tariffs, but the trade representative complains a lot about what the report calls the onerous and unnecessary rules and regulations in its trade agreements that exist already with the EU. So does this tell us something about the likely US starting point for a bilateral trade agreement after Brexit?
Yes, it does. If you look at international trade nowadays, actually, the real deal is no longer tariffs. This was the case after World War II in the 1950s, 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s. Tariffs were cut, and that was a big push for the global economy. Now, tariffs are really low. They've been cut down. If you think about the UK, the average tariff the UK has with the United States is something like 0.5%. So you can't cut it much further. Now, there are some exceptions in some industries, the food industry, for example, the car industry. Some tariffs are higher, so that's nothing to be sniffed at. Those could be cut, but on average, there's not much to be cut. Therefore, it's not about tariffs, it's about non-tariff barriers. What does that mean? That means diverging regulation. Think about car safety as an example. Cars are regulated. You can't just put any car on the street. Car safety regulation is different in the European Union from the United States. The objective is the same. Cars are supposed to be safe. Cars are not supposed to kill people unnecessarily in traffic. Now, one way of trying to bring down costs for businesses would be to try to harmonize those rules, or at least mutually recognize it. There's no evidence that cars in one jurisdiction are safer in a systematic way than in another. So perhaps we could mutually recognize them. Perhaps we could even come up with new rules. Think about driverless cars that we don't really have yet, but they're probably going to come up at some point. Well, that will require regulation. So maybe there's scope to cooperate. So that's all about regulation, transnational regulation. That's the big deal, and that needs to be negotiated. But that is much harder to do than cutting a few tariffs.
When you're talking about driverless cars, it brings to mind, even over the life of the negotiations of this agreement and afterwards, these things are constantly changing, aren't they, and moving. Does this mean that also that agreements are much more complex now because they have to reflect the changing state of technology, especially if you're dealing with someone like the United States?
a lot of agreements these days are supposed to be what's called a living agreement. That means it's not just something you agree at a certain point of time and then nothing happens ever after. They're supposed to be living on in the sense that you keep on talking to each other precisely, as you say, to react to new developments, new technologies, and so on. But also there are sometimes very long phase-in periods for tariff cuts. So sometimes it's very hard for a government to politically accept a cut in tariffs. Perhaps you want to protect your farmers, therefore you have high tariffs for your farms. To bring them down, to sweeten the bitter pill, what governments often agree on is, well, let's phase them out very slowly over long time horizons. So that in itself pushes a lot of the action far into the future. But when it comes to regulation, it's definitely something that is ongoing. It kind of will never stop. You have to keep on talking.
The trade representatives' report's also complaining that semi-autonomous regulators across the European Union don't do enough to adapt their standards and accreditation processes to help US exporters. Is there a problem here that the negotiators might want to throw away what they think is red tape, but the regulators would resist that?
Yeah, that's right. There's a mismatch, right? Negotiators want lots and lots of things on behalf of their governments, but they can't necessarily control these things. Regulation is a case in point. In many cases, regulators are fairly independent. They might be regulated by parliament, for example, not by government directly. So if the government of the day wants something done, it doesn't necessarily mean it can get parliament or Congress to act on it. And that creates this mismatch. And therefore, you often have a situation where perhaps a government wants to do something, agrees on something, but at the end of the day, find it very difficult to implement it. That's a very general complaint that lots and lots of countries have. A more specific complaint coming from the US with respect to the European Union is about how everything is so political in some areas. If you think about food safety, the European Union has their own independent scientific advisors, not advisors chosen by the US, but chosen by themselves in the European Union. They regularly give them their scientific independent advice, for example, on what sort of ingredients should be allowed in consumer food if you buy something in the supermarket. They come up with a recommendation, and then it gets shot down at the level of politicians in the European Commission. And that's incredibly frustrating to the United States because they kind of have an idea about what the scientific evidence says. They have access to the same evidence, but they can't then predict how the European Union is going to react to it. And that's the source of frustration that a lot of countries have with the European Union. And European Union politicians, and I think the population in general, are not quite aware of that. A nasty way of putting it would be to say there's a bit of a cultural arrogance. Europeans know best, especially when it comes to animal welfare, consumer welfare, environmental issues. The EU knows it all, and how could it be that other countries have something to say on that? You know, if you talk to people outside the European Union, they quite understandably have a slightly different view, and they find it very difficult to get through to the European Union on that front.
Does this put the UK in a bind if it's negotiating at the same time with the US and with its former European partners, that if it moves to the US on regulatory matters, it makes it harder to do deals with the European Union?
Absolutely. The UK, if it leaves the European Union and chooses to move quite a bit away from the European Union single market regulation, for example, it would sit in between if it does a deal with the US. And the further they move towards the US, the further they would move away from the European Union. And the problem for the UK is that neither the US nor the EU are going to bend over backwards to accommodate Britain. They're going to say, look, we're really large. We're 6-7 times larger than you are. Why on earth should we change our rules just for you? You're actually a fairly small partner. And I think that's something that a lot of people in the UK just do not understand yet. Trade politics is a game of bullying. Right now, the UK, and most people are not aware of that, is part of a big bully, because they're part of the European Union. And that served the UK very well. I mean, the UK, especially when it comes to trade policy, has had a disproportionately large influence on the European Union and European Union policy. And the size of the EU is really what matters. Now, once Britain is out, all that stops overnight, and they will suddenly be at the receiving end, certainly when they deal with the big guys, and that is the European Union, the United States, and China.
In 2017, there was a YouGov survey, and Brits said that they thought the US would be the most desirable partner for a future trade agreement. But when we look at the reality, you already mentioned TTIP and the draft terms of TTIP, which was the last attempt at a transatlantic trade deal. They were very unpopular in the UK. The British press are constantly warning us about the horrors of an American chlorinated chicken. So could it be that when the public sees the terms of any future trade deal, they're not going to like the reality as much as they like the idea, and they might hold it up?
Absolutely. Trade deals in the 21st century are controversial, period. The old school type of trade agreement was about cutting tariffs. That was much easier because we can somehow do some horse trading. You cut your tariff for something, I cut mine, and so on and so on. Not saying that was easy, but it was done. Most people would actually support that. The new type of trade agreement in the 21st century is about non-tariff barriers, regulation. And then it comes to areas that, where people feel very differently. Consumer safety, stuff that they eat, car safety, things that they buy, environmental protection. These will all be issues that are negotiated. And a lot of people feel deeply uncomfortable about this because they feel this is not something that should be done at an international level. It shouldn't be negotiated away. It should be decided domestically. The NHS is another issue. To what extent is the NHS purely a state organization? To what extent is there private investment? That's problematic in many people's views. Chlorinated chicken was kind of the picture, the case in point here. Hormone beef is another one. There's so many issues out there. And what the TTIP experience has taught us that if you do not, as a government, take the public with you, then you will lose that battle politically. It's really important to talk to the public. Some of these issues are losing games for politicians. There doesn't seem to be any gain. But you have to keep that battle up and you have to talk to people, otherwise you can forget about it.
Finally, Dennis, let's have a look at the people who are going to be the trade negotiators. The UK hasn't done any negotiating for many years because it's been part of the EU. In May, the British government reacted to this by setting up a training scheme for its future negotiators. And the government's chief trade negotiation advisor said at the time that this would ensure the government attracts the best and brightest talent. But when the UK finally sits down to negotiate with the US, how strong is each team going to be?
Right. So traditionally, the European Union, the people who negotiate trade deals in Brussels, are at the top of their game. You have people with an incredible amount of experience in there, and they're very, very good. Also, traditionally, that was true on the US side as well. Now, ever since the new US administration came in, things have changed a little bit. Their trade policy has been completely turned upside down. They're now all about trade deficits and trade surpluses, which is not really economically sensible. It's a different battle that they're fighting. So I'm not so sure whether the US side is equipped at the moment to do any trade deals, but that's not what they probably want to do anyway. Now, for Britain, as you said, Britain hasn't done any such thing in over 40 years, ever since they joined the European community, and therefore they have to build up that expertise. It's very difficult to build up that expertise overnight because you need a team that knows each other and people who have a lot of experience. It also means that you need to pay. And if you want a good trade negotiator, a lot of them are lawyers, they are highly qualified, highly experienced people, they will not be cheap. And there needs to be a great deal of flexibility for a fairly large number of people to pay them very well. That's not something that the British civil service likes to do. Also, there's this large degree of uncertainty. Of course, we don't know yet what the Brexit deal will look like at the end. In particular, we don't know yet whether the UK will leave the EU customs union or not. If they do not leave the customs union, essentially, the issue becomes almost, well, moot in the sense that the UK will not have an independent trade policy. So the role that Liam Fox currently has essentially becomes redundant and all the trade negotiations won't really be needed in that way. Well, they will be needed in some other ways, but not in a major way. And how do you attract good people if that's the uncertainty? I mean, do you accept a job where you don't even know whether your job will exist in less than a year from now? I think that's a big problem that the UK faces.
Dennis Novi, thank you very much. I feel we might be talking about this again.
I hope so, and I'm afraid so.
We've published and will publish a lot more coverage of this topic on Vox EU from experts like Dennis. And if Brexit trade deals are your thing, look out for our recent Vox talks called The Economics of Brexit and Trade Agreements, Brexit and the Way Forward. We've also heard that many of you wanted to listen to Vox Talks on mobile devices, so now you can find Vox Talks on Audioboom, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, all the major podcasting apps. This has been a Vox Talk presented by the Centre for Economic Policy Research. For more in the series, visit voxeu.org/vox-talks.